Ani, and welcome to Bombsida, an Aboriginal news magazine program that features news, current affairs, a focus on community and culture, spotlights on entertainment and great tunes, and every flavor from Aboriginal artists. I'm your host, Jennifer Ashwasage. There's a few things going on right now in the world of resource development and education. The Lake Huron Anishinaabeg Transmission Company will be building a transmission line in Ontario. The coastal First Nations are promising to continue fighting Enbridge from building its pipeline on sensitive environments, and the fight between a small group of Ecuadorian villagers and a Canadian mining company, as well as the Toronto Stock Exchange, is beginning to heat up in the courts. And Dr. Michael Oslins will give us his report on First Nations University of Canada hearings in Senate and the House of Commons. And continuing with education, Walk in Our Moccasins is a new report that has recently been launched by the Ontario Native Education Counseling Association. You'll hear these stories and a few excellent tunes right after the news. Here's your national Aboriginal news. A house at First Nation is booting out addicts, drug dealers, and bootleggers. Hereditary chiefs have ordered the offenders to get treatment or get out of the community. The Victoria Times Colonist also reports 30 people in a house that were given a day's notice in mid-March to get treatment, and most were taken to an 8-week treatment program with a focus on culture. Several people were served with notices they would be struck from the membership after they refused to attend the treatment. Council member Keith Atleo told the paper the community is the initiative because they want the cycle to be stopped. He said a few repeat offenders have already left, and the band is also working to ensure several non-Aboriginal people also leave the community. The community has 1,800 citizens with 800 on reserve, which is a 45-minute boat trip from Tofino on the west coast of Vancouver Island. For years, a house that has struggled with youth suicide and drug and alcohol abuse. A similar attempt was made 3 years ago to send about 20 offenders for treatment, but they have since relapsed and the problem exacerbated during an economic downturn. The Assembly of First Nations is calling on government to reinstate funding to the Aboriginal Healing Foundation. The foundation provides program assistance for residential school survivors and their families. First Nation groups are concerned that the government didn't renew funding. The program was initiated in 1998 when $350 million was set aside to support Aboriginal community initiatives. In 2007, the Harper government committed $125 million for the program, and the AFN is requesting an additional $125 to continue healing program support. AFN Grand Chief Sean Atleo says First Nations can't heal 100 years of injury in 12 years, and he adds there needs to be continued government commitment. And the NDP is calling for an emergency debate to discuss the allocation of continued funding. A group of First Nations in Ontario will be building new electrical infrastructure in the province. The Lake Huron Anishinaabeg Transmission Company has been in discussions with the Ministry of Energy as well as power authorities in the province. CEO John Bocash says they're pleased with discussions so far, and he says there's a ministerial directive to involve First Nations in electrical projects.
Last year, George Smitherman was the Minister of Energy. He actually sent a ministerial directive to the Ontario Power Authority and to Hydro One, saying that, in effect, when development, electrical development happening in First Nation territories, the First Nations must be involved, and it was a must be involved. It wasn't may be involved.
Bocash says that means the ball is now in the First Nations court.
With that kind of a directive, then it really is up to us to show that we can become involved in a very businesslike manner, that we can raise the capital required for these huge projects, and that we have the technical and the legal and the management wherewithal to make sure that these projects are done correctly and done within budget.
Transmission lines will be built from Sault Ste. Marie to Sudbury, and a north-south line from Sudbury to Toronto, as well as an enabler line from Manitoulin Island to Espanola. Gang violence has been plaguing a First Nation community in Alberta. One member has recently been sent to prison after involvement in a shooting about 2 years ago. The community has already begun its long road to recovery after admitting there is a problem in the community. Bombsida Co-op student Deidre Conton has this story.
Samson Cree First Nation is addressing the gang problem in their community, but wants some badly needed funding to deal with the issues. The First Nation began tackling the problem after the drive-by shooting of a toddler about 2 years ago. Meanwhile, Christopher Crane was sentenced March 29th to 9 years in prison for shooting the toddler, Asia Saddleback. Unlike any problem, it took a devastating event to trigger many of the 12,000 residents to realize that there is a problem. Volunteers have been working with youth, and the community has been looking to its elders to teach cultural and spiritual traditions. Most of the residents are under 18 years old, with another good portion of the population under 10. A community spokesperson says, funding to develop new programs for the youth is desperately needed to address current issues as well as be ready for the next age group. For Bombsida, I'm Deidre Conton.
Three Ecuadorian villagers are continuing their fight with a Canadian mining company and the Toronto Stock Exchange. Toronto lawyer Murray Klippenstein is representing the Ecuadorians. He says the villagers want to hold the mining company accountable in its originating country.
Their view is the problem originates here in Canada. It's Canadian money from the Toronto Stock Exchange. It's a Canadian mining company. And they can sit in Canada or in Ontario, pull some strings, and we are dodging bullets in our home.
The villagers from Intag, which is in northwestern Ecuador, are suing the Copper Mesa Mining Company and the Toronto Stock Exchange. Klippenstein says the lawsuit is unprecedented and a challenge to the mining companies and the stock exchange. The matter was heard in a Toronto court March 25th, and Klippenstein says the company wants the lawsuit tossed out.
The mining company's lawyers and the stock exchange lawyers asked the judge to throw the case out before any evidence is heard.
Klippenstein says he expects the lawsuit to go on for about 5 to 10 years, and he says it will be a long time before there's even a trial. Students enrolled at First Nations University of Canada will be able to finish out the school year. After much debate, the federal government has pledged $3 million to the struggling university. Indian Affairs Minister Chuck Schumer says the government is determined to help students finish out their year. What's not known, however, is if the government will continue to commit funding the university in coming years. That issue wasn't discussed at a March 31st press conference. The federal money will run out August 31st of this year. And the National Aboriginal Caucus Representative Thomas Rosen says the government has hung the university out to dry. Rosen says the federal government is ignoring its treaty obligation to fund Aboriginal education. And he adds, while the government of Saskatchewan has recognized the vital need for a First Nations institution, Ottawa is turning its back on the only such university in Canada. The Dakota people in Manitoba are welcoming the arrival of a rare white bison to their home. The six-month-old calf was handed over to Sioux Valley Dakota Nation just west of the city on March 29th. Wayne Eastman is an elder from South Dakota. He told the Winnipeg Free Press, the birth of the white bison is a good omen. The white female bison calf is significant to Northern Plains First Nations because of a 2,000-year-old legend, the White Buffalo Calf Woman. The legend goes that a maiden appeared bearing a sacred pipe she used to teach the people to pray, and upon leaving, she promised to return someday and usher in a time of great peace. And as she moved away, the maiden turned into a white buffalo calf. Chief Donna Elk of the Sioux Valley Dakota Nation says the white bison calf will have lots of room to roam in its new home, as well as lots of visitors. And that's your National Aboriginal News.
Trying to break down what's been going on in my mind. Living on a short time, walking a fine line between good fortune and misery. Gonna find peace of mind, 'cause I keep on trying. Gotta keep on trying till they put me in the grave. Second verse is the rundown of a lowdown. Information with a positive vibe. They try to break you, try to make you into something you don't ever wanna be. But I find peace of mind, 'cause I keep on trying. Gotta keep on trying. Put me in the grave.
amplified in a song. A few words of wisdom. Believe I don't ramble long. You can take what you hear, just leave it alone. Gonna find peace of mind. Better keep on trying. Gotta keep on trying. Till it put me in the grave.
On trying from J.C. Campbell. The Lake Huron Anishinaabeg Transmission Company is moving forward with its plan to be a major part of a large transmission project in Ontario. John Bokash is the CEO of the company, and he says the project won't move forward without First Nations involvement.
When there is a new transmission line for electricity going through the territory, we should be involved in it. Unlike the past where transmission lines just went through with Ontario Hydro and we were never consulted, we were never part of the process, and we didn't benefit from any of these past transmission lines. New Supreme Court decisions and various treaty decisions have led us to this point where we do have some say into how transmission lines or other kind of developments will happen within our territory. So we've made it very clear to the Ontario government, to Hydro One, and to other companies that are involved in lines that when a new transmission line comes through, then we are going to be a major proponents with that transmission line, and thus the Lake Huron Anishinaabeg Transmission Line Company. And so we're going forward with discussions with Hydro One and with Great Lakes Power and other proponents to talk about partnerships and to make sure that we are involved and we have benefit out of any new transmission lines coming through the Lake Huron Treaty area.
I understand that there's a transmission line project in the works in your area.
Yes, there is, and really results from things that are happening with the Green Energy Act of Ontario. And the Green Energy Act was put into law about a year and a half ago, and then out of that came what's called a FIT application process, and that's a feed-in tariff application process for new green energy projects in Ontario. And there's a lot of green energy projects that are scheduled to go online, and they're right alongside the Great Lakes. And because of the whole aspects with wind power and other types of power, it's not a steady line with nuclear power or with electricity. It's sort of up and down because the wind changes each day. So the old technology often has trouble with the new green power. And on top of that, there's not enough capacity in the present line. So a new line will have to be built, and it actually comes from as far away as the Manitoba border all the way down to Toronto.
Don't you think that's a case of too little too late because the governments are looking at renewing a nuclear power plant projects?
Well, no, I don't think it is. I think that for one thing is that we have to look at power that is an alternative to nuclear. We also are looking that in the province of Ontario, we're going to be decommissioning our coal-fired plants over the next number of years, and there's significant power that's being produced right now by coal-fired plants. So there are two things in play. One is the increasing population in Ontario. We're also looking at possibly our manufacturing sector starting to build up again over the next 10 years. And then with that, there's going to be an increase in demand for power. And then with the supply, us losing supply over the next while with coal-fired plants going online, we do need the green power to fill in the gap. And you look at the enormous cost of a nuclear plant. That green power will really fit the bill in this whole region. The only thing is that green power does cost a little bit more per kilowatt, and And unfortunately, I think that's probably going to be something that will have to be looked at very closely by all of the people in Ontario, in that energy costs will go up. There's no if it will go up or what. It's when and how much.
So we were talking about transmission lines will be treaty areas. Can you tell us what exactly area that is?
Well, the ones that we are specifically working on are a transmission line from Sault Ste. Marie to Surrey, and a north-south line from Sudbury to Toronto, and then an enabler line that would go from Manitoulin Island to Espanola to catch the east-west line. These lines would be bringing power mostly to southern Ontario. So they would be roughly parallel to the current lines that are there. There are some major lines running north-south, and we can see that just outside of Parry Sound. And there are east-west lines that we can see in some places close to the road. So they are going to be relatively close to the present lines.
And how are talks going with government and power authorities?
Well, actually, we're very encouraged by the talks that we've had with the Minister of Energy thus far. Last year, when George Smitherman was the Minister of Energy, he actually sent a ministerial directive to the Ontario Power Authority and to Hydro One, saying that, in effect, when there is development, electrical development happening in First Nation territories, the First Nations must be involved, and it was a must be involved. It wasn't may be involved. So it was very clear, and with that kind of a directive, then it really is up to us to show that we can become involved in a very business-like manner, that we can raise the capital required for these huge projects, and that we have the technical and the legal and the management wherewithal to make sure that these projects are done correctly and done within budget.
That was Don Bocash, CEO of the Lake Huron Anishinaabeg Transmission Company. Walk in Our Moccasins is a new report that has been recently released by the Ontario Native Education Counseling Association, or ONECA. The report highlights the importance of the roles that First Nation education counselors play in the success of students. Here's ONECA President Cindy Fisher.
The Walk in Our Moccasins report is, I believe, the first of its kind, and it's from the ground up. It's right from the counselors themselves, and the purpose of the whole report was to look at what are the rules, because what do counselors do at First Nation level? Because counselors roll right from one area of Ontario to the other end. Like, you go from one to the other end, the roles are quite diverse. But the thing that we needed to know was, what do counselors need in order to help their students become successful? Because the needs are obviously different from First Nation to First Nation. And the roles of the counselors are tremendously different. But we had started this way back, last fall was when we started. But in the meantime, that's when the Usher report came out. And Usher report basically said, like right in his report, that counselors do next to nothing to support students. And I'm thinking, we're thinking, oh my God, that's just not true. So this is a timely report that comes out and talks about exactly what counselors do and exactly what do they see as needed for student success.
And what are some of those things that students need to see success in school?
Counselor plays a really key role, with support services, right in the institutions themselves, like at the post-secondary level, like the community. They're like a grounding force for counselors. They provide I would say wide range. Just that being there for students, for one thing, being the grounding force, support services for them. The connection to home, their sounding board. One of the things as well that came out was that students identified, with the counselors as well, the need for parental support, parental and community support. Counselors you know, also provide guidance. They provide advocacy. Like, sometimes, you know, when students are coming out and going off to not only to college or university, but are going out and finding a place to live for the first time, you know, like those kinds of things. Some students go through tremendous, they're up against so many different things that counselors just provide the support for them to be able to take it one step at a time.
So can you just tell me what the students are facing in respect to roadblocks to education?
Well, first of all, I really believe that students, or, well, students, all of us, we really need to be grounded in who we are as Anishinaabe people. You know, we really need that grounding. And there's just things that have happened in our lives that sometimes that grounding is not possible. You know, and yes, there is community and there is parental responsibility. However, you can't really acknowledge or you can really protect something that you don't know that was ever there. You know, like the fallout that we have from the residential school, the fallout we have from our current education system in First Nation communities itself with the severe, like we're severely underfunded as far as dollars go.
That was Cindy Fisher, president of the Ontario Native Education Counseling Association, and she was discussing ONECA's report, Walk in Our Moccasins. Tanya Tagak is an Inuit throat singer from Cambridge Bay. She moved away to attend university in Nova Scotia, and Tanya perfected her art during a bout of loneliness. Because she was missing home so much, her mom sent her some tapes of Inuit throat singing, and learned just how to do that from those tapes. Here's Origin from Tanya Tagak. Ecuadorian villagers from Intag are continuing their fight with the Canadian Mining Company and the Toronto Stock Exchange. And according to Toronto lawyer Murray Klippenstein, who is representing the three, the fight promises to be a long one. He says the villagers want to hold the mining company and Toronto Stock Exchange accountable in its originating country.
Ecuadorian villagers have come to Ontario to for a court appearance in a lawsuit they've started against the mining company in Canada that wants to create a giant open pit mine near their villages in the mountains in the forests of Ecuador, and security forces were assaulting them for their opposition to the mine.
And I understand that opposition to this mine has been ongoing for quite some time.
Yeah, the villagers in this Intag area have had mining companies come into their area for many years, and they made their opposition clear to an open pit mine idea. They want their forests and rivers and mountains and the ecology in it to be preserved, not to be destroyed. And they repeatedly protest. The municipality has passed resolutions refusing allow mining. The mining company from Canada, they say, hired thugs with guns and bulletproof vests to attack them and to threaten them repeatedly to prevent them from successfully opposing the mine. So this is an example, it looks like, of a Canadian mining company going abroad thousands of kilometers away into a remote area and engaging in human rights abuses in a way that I think most Canadians would not see as tolerable.
Yeah, especially in our own backyard.
Yes, I think many First Nations people would say, we know about this kind of thing. We've experienced it. Mining companies coming in and with little disregard for the environment, for our traditional way of living, and in a sneaky kind of way, with despite the opposition, using rules or even force, in Northern Ontario, even imprisoning First Nation leaders to get their way with the mines.
And I also understand that this is the first that someone taking a Canadian company to court in Canada.
This is pretty unprecedented for folks from another country far away who are being affected by a Canadian mining company to come to Canada and sue them in the courts here. It's because some courts will say, well, you should go bring a lawsuit in Ecuador where you live. But their view is the problem originates here in Canada. It's Canadian money from the Toronto Stock Exchange. It's a Canadian mining company. And they can sit in Canada or in Ontario, pull some strings, and we are dodging bullets in our home. So they said, surely the Canadian laws can hold some accountability here, and surely the Canadian people don't realize what's going on and wouldn't support this. So they came here.
And how did they find you?
We had acquaintances, and so they, when they came to Canada or Ontario years ago, they spoke with me. I have done some work with First Nations communities in Canada, including in the north, where mining companies can be a problem. And so we went to Ecuador and visited their communities there, met with the community leaders and the people, and talked about it. And they decided they wanted to do this. They wanted to come to Canada and use the laws and use the courts. They say we want justice, and we'll go to Canada, where the company comes from, to hopefully get it.
So, is there anybody else that has any interest in this case, such as the UN or any other groups similar to that?
There are many organizations all around the world who know and are concerned that mining companies, especially small mining companies as they're known, are often involved in human rights abuses all over the world. In Ecuador, this was the subject of a complaint to the OECD, the local or the Ecuadorian human rights organization, and Amnesty International have expressed concern about this particular situation in Ecuador. So yes, there's broad concern with these folks, Olivio and Israel and Marcia, or Carlos are doing here, is saying truly this is something the law needs to address. So they're bringing it, but many other organizations are concerned as well.
So when does the matter go to court, and where are we at in the process?
This is a case that's a big, big challenge to the mining companies and the mining finance industry. And so we expect them to fight hard against it, and they already are. When we met with the folks in Ecuador, we said the court system has many good things about it, but it certainly works very, very slowly, and it gives a lot of opportunity for them to use procedures to slow you down, stop you. So we expect to fight for years. I told them it could be 5 or 10 years. We were in court this week on last week on Thursday for one of those procedural steps. The mining company's lawyers and the stock exchange lawyers asked the judge to throw the case before any evidence is heard. And we don't have the court decision yet. We expect that in a few weeks. Quite possible that there will be an appeal from that decision. So it's a long time before we'll have the trial.
Mm-hmm.
Probably years.
Wow. Okay. And is there anything else you'd like to say or add about this case?
I think that everyone in Ontario and Canada may want to think about how the companies in the mining industry may be leaving a bad taste in people's mouths or a bad impression in their minds in Ecuador, all over the world, when they abuse human rights and use trickery and threats of violence and actual violence. But the same applies in our backyard in Ontario's north with First Nations people. So we have some homework to do, and I think that there should be some legal accountability as a step forward.
That was Toronto lawyer Murray Klippenstein, who is representing the Ecuadorians who are suing a Canadian mining company, the Copper Mesa Mining Corporation, plus the Toronto Stock Exchange. First Nation groups on the West Coast are promising to block Enbridge's proposed pipeline. It's the export pipeline that is to carry oil sands crude to export markets in China. Coastal First Nations is a coalition of First Nation members from several communities in the area around Kitimat. Art Sterrett is the executive director of the group.
Coastal First Nations have been analyzing Enbridge's proposal now for going on to 5 years. We commissioned some scientific studies of potential impact, negative and positive, and then we entered into a number of community consultations with all of the communities within our geographic area in the Great Bear Rainforest on the coast. And the end result of that was our communities decided that there were no real benefits that could come out of Enbridge, the tank traffic on the coast, and in fact, the impending disaster of an oil spill, which we're not questioning whether it'll occur. We're just wondering when it'll occur, if it ever happens. And so they've given us instructions to do everything we can to stop tanker traffic from entering onto the coast.
Okay, and what else is at stake here? You're talking about potential oil spills, and if there is a potential oil spill, what would that mean?
Well, on the coast, I mean, we really are in quite a depressed area, and, you know, throughout Canada, things are not, you know, the economy's just coming back to life. But on the coast, for some time now, we have been in a depressed state. The communities that I work with have unemployment rates ranging anywhere from 85% up to 95%. We really are, the fishing industry is down, the logging industry is down, everything is down. And we're in the process of trying to rebuild a more sustainable economy, and the one that isn't kind of dependent on, you know, just one industry. And we have gone out and garnered a lot of resources. We've spent millions, tens of millions on coming up with land use plans and marine use plans that would allow us to build a sustainable economy. We've raised in excess of $200 million to do this. We have funds available to us to build a sustainable economy. Everything that we've done, one oil spill would wipe it all out. It would just be over. And not only that, as you know, the area that we're in, despite the fact that, you know, the economy is depressed, our people still have a certain optimism to them. And the reason they have that is because they can go out their front door, get in their boat, their skiff, and go out and get the food that they need to sustain themselves. So our cultures, our society is alive and well, despite the fact that there aren't a heck of a lot of jobs and stuff. And so here we are. We have a proposal that is offering absolutely no benefits to us. No jobs, no benefits whatsoever. All it's offering is risk, and risk to society that over, 10,000 years has managed to put a rise and fall of fish stocks and become quite a sophisticated society with a, a highly developed art form and all the rest of it. So we're not willing to put that at risk. And our communities have told us that we can't put it at risk. We have a responsibility to maintain our culture, our society, and tanker traffic on the coast based on our studies around the world have demonstrated that there will be an oil spill if about to happen.
You were saying something about no jobs and no benefits, and just to play the devil's advocate, if there were those jobs and benefits, would Coastal First Nations go ahead with a deal like this?
No, I don't. No. I think that, the fact that there is nothing out there that is on the positive side, we've been, the proponents for this have said, oh, look, maybe if we train some people, you could run some tugboats or you could do some little things here and there. But the reality is our people have said it's not the kind of economy we want. We want an economy that is sustainable. We just came out of a fishing industry that sustained us economically for, 100 to 120 years. That industry died, and we are not about to allow ourselves to become dependent on something that we know is going to go away. Oil is not a sustainable industry. It's going to eventually expire, despite the fact that the tar sands and all of it may have, a 30 or a 40 lifespan. We're not looking at hanging our hat on such a short time frame. Our sustainable economy has to be forever, and oil doesn't offer that. Oil is not a renewable resource. It's not the kind of economy our communities are building.
And what do you think of the fact that Enbridge is acting as a corporate sponsor for many events and First Nations are accept that money?
For many events? I mean, I don't know what you're talking about, although I know what you're getting at, and you probably have better information than I do, but I know that Enbridge has put money into different First Nations for consultation. In fact, we ourselves accepted some money from Enbridge about 5 years ago, which we put into our scientific analysis. And there are many First Nations that are doing that. So Enbridge has an obligation that's been passed on from Canada to them to do some consultation, and they're doing that, and we acknowledge that. But we as an organization are no longer in the room accepting any resources from Enbridge, because our communities have made up their mind about the project.
And if the project goes ahead, what then?
Well, we're going to be taking exhausting all in use to stop the project. In British Columbia, there's Aboriginal title, which doesn't exist in the same way in other provinces. That's been affirmed by our Constitution and supported by the Supreme Court of Canada, that Aboriginal title and rights exist in British Columbia, and we fully expect to use every legal means that we can to stop this project, and whatever other means are necessary as well at the end of the day. Our people said we can't allow this to happen.
That was Art Sterrett, Executive Director of Coastal First Nations, on the group's promise to block Enbridge's proposed pipeline. Here's Sacred Ground from Peacemaker. We'll be right back. The First Nations University of Canada has been coming up a lot in the news lately. There have been allegations of staff misuse of funds and services, and now the matter has come up in the Senate and House of Commons. Both have been holding hearings and discussions about the only Indigenous university in Canada. Dr. Michael Poslins is a policy analyst and is becoming a regular on BOMCEDAW to speak on issues that are up in the House of Commons and Senate. This week, Dr. Poslins reports on the FNUC hearings.
The Commons Aboriginal Affairs Committee is now chaired by an MP by the name of Bruce Stanton from Simcoe North, and the vice chairs are Todd Russell, Liberal from Labrador, Jean Crowdy, an NDP MP from Nanaimo, Cowichan in BC. The Commons Aboriginal Affairs Committee got down to real business at its second meeting. Jean Crowder raised the issue of the First Nations University of Canada and made a motion that the committee call witnesses from the Faculty Association, the Federation of Saskatchewan Indian Nations, the University of Regina, and the Canadian Association of University Teachers, among others. Jean Crowder said that her motion was partially in response to the government's announcement that they were withdrawing their $7.2 million contribution to the FNUC. The motion was intended to allow all parties study both the actual on-the-ground situations of the FNUC and of the government's policy. Listeners may recall that the FNUC accreditation was suspended until such time as the governing board was reorganized so that the university would no longer be under the active political control of the FNIN, Federation of Saskatchewan Indian Nations. But the expectation was that once the problems of political interference were cleared up, the university's accreditation and its funding would be continued. The decision of the federal government to withdraw its funding, regardless of the university achieving independence, is a new and very different policy on the part of the federal government, not one that is shared, as far as we know, by either the province of Saskatchewan or the Association of Universities. How was Jean Crowder's motion received by the committee? The Conservative members opposed at the time. The Bloc Québécois MP, Marc Lemay, said his party would support it, and the Liberals also supported it. Duncan said the motion would be more appropriate if they were to talk to the chief financial officer. More persuasively, he noted that the committee had only very limited time and the motion would need to be studied before the end of March. He suggested that if it were to be accepted, the committee should do the work required over and above their regular work. Jean Crowder assured the committee she'd be happy to accept an amendment which would include any other witness the committee considered necessary. The motion was finally carried by 6-4, and on March 23rd, they held a hearing specifically on FNUC. The committee heard five witnesses, each with a different connection to First Nations University. First, Chief Guy Lones, the newly elected chief of the Federation of Saskatchewan Indian Nations. Second, Diane Adams from the First Nations University Students Association. Third, Leanne Timmons, president and vice chancellor of the University of Regina. Fourth, Randy Lundy, the chair of the First Nations University Academic Council. And James Turk, executive director of the Canadian Association of University Teachers. Each of these witnesses had 5 minutes to state their case. They pretty clearly organized themselves in advance so that there was one consistent. I think I can sum that message up pretty quickly here. Some years ago, the executive of the Federation of Saskatchewan Indian Nations began to interfere with the governance of the First Nations University in ways that are generally considered highly improbable in Canada, where universities, although chartered and funded by government, are highly independent from governments in their governance and regulation. Some part of the interference affected the financial management as well as the membership of the Board of Governors. The Canadian Association of Universities and Colleges had censured FNUC and given it a limited time in which to reform itself. The gist of Chief Gary Lonechild's testimony was that he ran for the leadership of the FSIN last fall, specifically on a platform of cleaning up the relationship between FSIN and FNUC. And since taking office, he had taken all the major steps necessary. He and the chiefs of the Federation had directed the board of the university to depoliticize itself. A working group had been set up in mid-February to oversee the transition. That group included the Federation, the FNUC board, University of Regina, with which FNUC had its history, and with Indian Affairs sitting in as observer. A memorandum of understanding was achieved among those parties for the steps to be taken to achieve the transition and put FNUC back on the path to a well-functioning academic institution. Unfortunately, on February 4th, while this transition was in progress, Rob Norris, the provincial minister for advanced education, announced that he was ending Saskatchewan's $5.2 million contribution to FNUC. 4 days later, on February 8th, Chuck Strahl, the Minister of Indian Affairs, announced he was canceling the federal participation of $7.2 million. Each of the witnesses, after Chief Lonechild, agreed that the necessary reforms had all taken place or were in progress, and that without the federal funding that the minister had canceled, the university would fold up, despite its unique role as the only Indigenous university in Canada. Diane Adams told a personal story of starting her academic career as an undergraduate at another university and transferring to FNUC because it had a program specifically designed to study environmental health and science in a program designed to equip professionals to work in First Nations and other Aboriginal communities. Vianne Timmons said the FNUC was one of three federated colleges at the University of Regina. FNUC, he said, offers 18 different degree programs and more than 10 diploma programs, all of which lead to degrees and diplomas issued by the University of Regina. FNUC was founded to enhance the quality of life, to preserve, protect, and interpret the history, language, culture, and artistic heritage of First Nations people. He said that the challenges that had been facing FNUC had all been addressed. The 6 weeks' notice the federal government had given for its defunding of FNUC would have a long series of unfortunate consequences. He gave one example that I think sums up the situation as a whole. He spoke of an older Cree woman who had gone back to school and is just completing her PhD. She's the sole provider for her grandchildren. The end of federal funding means that she will not be able to afford to complete her degree and will likely lose her home. While the witnesses were answering questions, Vianne Timmons received a message that all partners had signed a contract to do a shared management agreement. The provincial government, Federation of Saskatchewan Indian Nations, and First Nations University and the University of Regina. So the only one participating now is the federal government, Department of Indian Affairs. And it remains to be seen whether the federal department will resume its funding at some point soon. Jean Kreder reminded the committee that when the minister was before the committee the week before, he had no knowledge of the proposal that was being put forward to rescue FNUC. The minister had also said the money would continue to be available, but it would go to individual students and not to maintaining the university. The last point emphasized by witnesses is that no other university in the country is expected to run on a year-to-year funding with no assurance that the funding will continue beyond the current fiscal year. Neither can a university proposal-based funding without also having core funding as money to meet the cost of maintaining buildings and the administration of the university. So far, there is no indication that the Minister of Indian Affairs is willing to recognize that the FNUC is now on a path to proper governance and is in agreement with the province of Saskatchewan and all the other key players.
That was Dr. Michael Poslins discussing First Nations University of Canada hearings in the House of Commons and the Senate. You've been listening to Bombsida with Jennifer Ashwasagay. Bombsida is an Aboriginal news magazine program which includes current affairs, arts and entertainment, and a cross-genre of music from Aboriginal artists. Bombsida means walking together in the Anishinaabe language. Music for the program is courtesy of Burnt Project One. If you have comments or story ideas, visit my website at bombsida.com. That's B-A-M-O-S-E-D-A. And thanks for listening to Bombsida.